You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
We have ships heading to Iran right now, big ones, biggest and the best.
President Trump is wise enough to make the correct decision.
The law of power is prevailing over the power of law.
Today we are producing more than 3 million pages.
What happened to the other 3 million? What's in them?
Emotional, fashionable, cinematic.
Welcome to World News Weekly. I'm Katrina Stirrett. Joining me is international correspondent Claudia Farhat in Jakarta.
Hello, Kat. Who's that strange man you've got there with you?
I know. In an exciting turn of events, our chief international correspondent Ben Lewis is joining me from the Sydney studio this week. Welcome,
it's
Ben.
Nice to be here. And I've had 4 weeks off. I haven't been following the news, so expect some incisive analysis. I turned on my phone this morning to see if Greenland still belonged to Denmark and what was going on in the world. And
it's
I was
good.
Surprised.
You're coming in fresh. It'll be fresh analysis.
I'm ready.
Almost as big news as having Ben Lewis in the Sydney office this week is the massive fallout as a string of high-profile figures are named in over 3 million documents tied to late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein.
Plus, optimism being tested in Ukraine as Russia launches a large-scale attack ahead of a second round of trilateral talks to end the war.
But first, a massive US military build-up circling Iran as the United States presses for a nuclear deal.
And on Iran, sir, can you say what your threshold for military action is?
Well, I can't tell you what I'm going to do because right now, we have a tremendous force going there, just like we did in Venezuela, even bigger. And they'll be there soon, and I'd like to see a deal negotiated. I don't know that that's going to happen, but right now we're talking to them. We're talking to Iran, and if we could work something out, that'd be great. And if we can't, probably bad things would happen.
The U.S. president there laying out the stakes ahead of a new round of nuclear talks with Iran, which were scheduled to begin on Friday in Istanbul. The Middle East has once again been on edge this week, with Washington staging a massive military build-up in the seas near Iran. Donald Trump says his armada will be ready to strike if Iran doesn't agree to his demands at this next round of talks. Tehran is responding with threats of its own. Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has said if Iran comes under attack from the US again, it will trigger a regional war. The US says it's already shot down one Iranian drone flying towards one of its aircraft carriers, so there's certainly a feeling that this could escalate at any moment. And in the background to all of this, we saw two separate explosions in Iran this week that left at least five people dead, including one in a city where the Revolutionary Guard Corps is known to have naval assets. So they were immediately met with speculation that the Revolutionary Guard commanders were being targeted. Iranian officials are blaming gas leaks for the incidents, and officials from both Israel and the US have denied involvement. But it's only added to all of this tension. Claudia, let's start with Washington's threats to strike Iran once again. What do you think Trump's endgame is here?
So hard to say, Kat, and also so hard to say what their strategy in this might actually be. I mean, it could go any one of 100 ways from here, but I think the hint might be in what we just heard Donald Trump say, where he said that the US is amassing a force near Iran, just like it did with Venezuela. So I guess the speculation we're now hearing is that Washington might be planning some sort of swift surgical strike on senior leaders, potentially all the way to the top in Iran, to the Ayatollah, as we saw with Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. The difference being between the two situations is that Iran is still far, far more powerful. It's still got its regional proxies, although, yes, they have taken, you know, severe hits since the war in the Middle East broke out once again in October 2023. But we've also seen reports that since the 12-day war last year, Iran has not only rebuilt the stockpile of missiles it used up during that fighting, but it's actually now amassed more firepower than it had going into it. So there is, you know, the very real potential that if the US did launch an attack on Iran, Iran could sort of, you know, unleash those stockpiles and sort of swarm the US's defenses. And the other thing to consider here is, I mean, we're still yet to actually see the Iranian regime respond to a real existential threat. So in the past, when there have been sort of limited strikes, you know, Iran has sort of responded in kind, launching attacks on, you know, US bases in the region, but they've largely been symbolic and not really designed to cause any great harm. So if it was met with an existential threat, I mean, we'd kind of be in uncharted territory there. And there are, you know, many, many US bases in the region sitting there waiting to be targeted. I think part of the reason it's so hard to tell where this is going as well is we don't know what Trump's end game is. I mean, first it was about the protests. He said if they started killing Iranian protesters, he would strike. Well, they killed many thousands of them and no strike came. Then it was about the nuclear program, but last year he told us the nuclear program had been obliterated. And then there's the question, well, is it really about regime change? On that, Israel has interestingly been surprisingly quiet. Usually we sort of hear the Israeli leadership, you know, egging Washington on, trying to get them to launch one of these strikes. There were reports in Israeli media that Benjamin Netanyahu had actually asked him to hold off last month during those protests to try plan a more far-reaching strike. So it's really interesting, I think, that we haven't heard much from them yet.
Ben, I'm keen to get your thoughts on that too. What do you think the US president is actually trying to achieve here? Is this really about the nuclear program or is it something else?
Look, on the idea of regime change, you would like to think that there are senior people within the Trump administration and the US military who are saying to Donald Trump, it's not going to work. If you get rid of the supreme leader, you have a country where, say, that, you know, Revolutionary Guard figures took over. They are so ingrained in every aspect of life in Iran. They've got fingers in every little pie. Life is still going to be pretty average for the people of Iran, even if you do take out a few top leaders. The nuclear program, yes, I guess it probably is about doing some sort of nuclear deal, despite the fact that, again, we always have to remember that it was Trump who scrapped the first nuclear deal that was negotiated in the first place. It's interesting that in recent days, Donald Trump has stopped talking about the wider ballistic missile program that Iran has and has focused almost entirely talking about the nuclear weapons program that the US believes they have. Israel, of course, is concerned not only by the nuclear program, but also by the ballistic missile program. And we saw last year during the 12-day war, the enormous impact that those ballistic missiles had, despite the incredible air defense systems that Israel has present. So you have Israel and the United States perhaps both wanting different things from this. Donald Trump likes fast, flashy military action. We saw that in Venezuela. We saw that last year with the limited US strikes on the nuclear facilities in Iran. If I had to put my money on it, I would think that if there is any form of military action, that is what Donald Trump would be hoping for, not some sort of prolonged conflict. But of course, in that part of the world, when you set events in motion, you can't always be entirely sure when they're going to end up. Just briefly on what Claudia said before about the Israeli government not saying a huge amount at the moment. I was chatting to some contacts in Israel a few weeks ago, and they were saying that the Israeli government was asking the US to hold back on action because it simply doesn't have the supplies of interceptor missiles for its Iron Dome systems. It knows that if the US attacks Iran in a meaningful way, Iran will probably strike back at targets in Israel, and they're not sure they're properly prepared yet. The Israeli government would love the United States to go in all guns blazing in Iran. Whether they're ready, though, to defend what they need to defend from isn't really clear.
Yeah, so there's clearly a lot riding on these talks on Friday. It looked like it was all set to go ahead in Istanbul, but Iran is now demanding a last-minute change of venue. They want it to take place in Oman now, which the Trump administration has apparently agreed to. Donald Trump is set to send his envoy Steve Witkoff, and the Iranians say they are sending Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi. He gave an interview to CNN over the weekend and insisted Iran is seeking a negotiated end to this. Here's some of what he had to say.
President Trump said no nuclear weapons, and we are fully agree. We fully agree with that. That could be a very good deal. Of course, in return, we expect sanction lifting. If war starts, that would be a disaster for everybody. We learned many lessons from those 12 days of war, and I think we are now very well prepared. But again, being prepared doesn't mean that we want war. We want to prevent a war.
Ben, are Iran more likely to negotiate given those US strikes in June last year? Will they take the threat more seriously, do you think?
Well, they probably should. They are clearly happy to sit down and talk, which has not happened properly in a long time, with Steve Witkoff, who, despite a few questions about his qualifications, is obviously someone that Donald Trump trusts very much. But we're already seeing Tehran trying to move the goalposts of these talks. I mean, not only changing the location, they don't want representatives from other Middle Eastern countries to be there, and they clearly only want to talk about the nuclear program. They don't want to touch on their support for proxy groups or the wider ballistic missile program. So they're still trying to push the Trump administration a little bit here. They need to be careful, because we have seen Donald Trump before say negotiations are continuing, we're still in talks, and then the next day, bam, strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities. So they are pushing perhaps a little bit too much. We'll probably find out over the next week, I suspect.
Yeah, right. So I guess, Claudia, if this does come to blows, it's inevitably going to be felt beyond Iran. How do you think the rest of the region is reacting to all this?
Well, over the past few days, Kat, we've seen a sort of frenzy of diplomatic activity right across the region in the lead up to these talks. Originally, we heard that a bunch of foreign ministers from the region were going to be attending as well. And what they've all basically been trying to do over the past week or so is close the gaps between the US and Iran's positions, just to give these talks some chance at all of succeeding. The US originally had three pretty strong demands that they were going to bring to the table. They wanted zero enrichment of Iran's nuclear material. They wanted significant limits put on Iran's missile program as well. And they also wanted Iran to end all of its support for its regional proxies. All three of those have been red lines for Iran in the past, things they've always said they won't negotiate on. This time, Tehran is signaling it might be willing to make a compromise on the enrichment point, if they can get the wording right. For example, not enriching any further material, but perhaps not confiscating what they have already, or perhaps having to move it to a third country. But we're certainly hearing from Iran that they are not willing to negotiate on the other two points, on the missile program and on the ending support for its regional proxies, because those two things are really its two main deterrents in the region. It has missile stocks, as Ben was telling us, that are, you know, more than capable of reaching sites well inside Israel. And it has proxies right on Israel's doorstep that have been long willing to support them in military action against them. So I think that's why we're now hearing, a push to really limit these talks just to the nuclear issue, to give them, some chance at succeeding.
Nonetheless, it will be all eyes on Oman on Friday. We'll no doubt be updating you next week on how it all unfolds.
Is your money dirty money?
If you live.
I just asked a question. Is your money dirty money?
No, it's not. So, in fact...
Why is it not dirty money?
Because I earned it.
But you earned it... I earned it legally. We went back to this before. You earned it. Advising the worst people in the world.
That was late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein being grilled by an unknown interviewer, one video among millions of files released following a highly anticipated Trump election promise. The US president stubbornly resisted this release before succumbing to political pressure from within his own ranks late last year. Now the Department of Justice has shared another tranche of more than 3 million pages, 180,000 images and 2,000 videos related to an investigation into the disgraced Epstein. Trump's own name is mentioned thousands of times alongside a myriad of high-profile figures from the Clintons to Bill Gates, Elon Musk and even the Norwegian royals. But it's important to note that mention in the files does not imply any wrongdoing. Claudia, regardless, this is not something Trump wanted. His name is littered throughout the files. But the DOJ says there's no credible evidence to suggest criminal wrongdoing, going as far as to describe many of the claims as sensationalist. What's the reaction been?
Well, there's been a huge onslaught of criticism to how this release has been managed from survivors and from Trump's political opponents. The Department of Justice's reasons for delaying the release of these documents in the first place was that, you know, it had to sort through the files, make the appropriate redactions to protect the identities of the victims and to protect any sensitive material from being released. But in this dump, we have seen names and addresses of victims, of potential victims, released. And we've even seen them release nude photographs where the girls' and women's faces are clearly identifiable. So those reasons aren't quite stacking up. The Department of Justice has now removed thousands of these pages over the past a couple of days. It blamed either a tech error or a human error, but it has raised a whole lot of new questions about what exactly they've been doing with the files in all this time, and whether they were more concerned with sort of clearing potentially damaging references to the president, as the Democrats are alleging. So for Donald Trump, I don't think the questions are going to end here, even though the department is saying this will be the final release. There are still something like 2.5 million pages from these files that have not been released. Another 200,000 have been redacted. So there are still ongoing calls to release the rest of them. Also, just speaking about the victims, I mean, a lot of the discussion over the past week has been around who's named, you know, in the files, the powerful men. And understandably so, as you kind of listed off, there are powerful people from all around the world who appear in these things. But the Deputy Attorney General, Todd Blanche, when he was announcing this latest release, said there was nothing in the files, in these 3.5 million pages that we've seen so far, that have allowed them to prosecute anybody. In the same press conference, he also said that the reason some pages weren't released was that they depicted acts of child sexual abuse, physical abuse, and were also depictions of child pornography. There are now a lot of questions being asked over how those two statements can be compatible. How can you have evidence of child sexual abuse being committed, but also not have enough evidence to pursue any legal action against anybody? But as for the Department of Justice, you know, they're really sticking by the position that this is where it's going to end and that there'll be no further charges.
And there's been huge ripple effects outside America too, including in the UK. We've already heard plenty about alleged connections between the former Prince Andrew and Epstein, but now we're seeing consequences for political figures like Peter Mandelson and others. Is this a real test, Ben, for the Labor Party, especially given allegations Mandelson may have shared sensitive government files?
Yeah, it's a huge problem for the Labor government, and particularly for Prime Minister Keir Starmer. Now, Lord Mandelson, or Peter Mandelson, as he'll probably soon be known if they take away his lordship, he has been heavily involved in the British Labor Party for a very long time. He was one of the driving forces behind New Labor and Tony Blair back in the 90s. But in around the 2008 financial crash, he was serving as the business secretary. Now, the files have revealed that it appears he has sent some confidential, I guess, financial emails to Jeffrey Epstein at the time. And Number 10 has already said an initial review of those documents found they contained market-sensitive information, which is obviously something that a serving minister should not be doing to a private citizen of any kind, let alone someone like Jeffrey Epstein. Now, Gordon Brown, who was Prime Minister at the time, has referred this and passed documents on to the Metropolitan Police, who are investigating. So there could be some quite serious consequences for Mr. Mandelson, but also for Keir Starmer. When Starmer took power, he needed to find a new ambassador to the United States. He chose Peter Mandelson. Now, the idea was that he had lots of connections, not only in the United States, but particularly in Trump world. And it appears that during the vetting process, if there was much of one, this stuff didn't come up. Now, Prime Minister Starmer was telling his cabinet meeting the other day that Mandelson has let his country down and that the alleged passing on of emails was disgraceful. He also said he's not assured that the totality of information that was shared has properly emerged. But this is just, I mean, it's a free kick for his political opponents, for reform, for the Conservatives, saying this is the judgment of the Prime Minister, one of the first appointments he made, and this is the guy he chose. And it's even more embarrassing because there was that photograph of Mandelson standing over the top of a woman wearing his underpants on the front page of every newspaper in the United Kingdom. This is a real problem for the British government at the moment.
Yeah, it's clear the fallout from this extends beyond America and the Trump world for sure. As Ukrainian, US and Russian delegates embark on a second round of trilateral talks this week, the mood has shifted. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's optimism about a peace deal is now being tested further after Russia launched a massive drone and missile attack across multiple regions in Ukraine on Tuesday. This attack came after a week-long energy truce brokered by US President Donald Trump to help ease the pressure on civilians during an extreme winter period. Here's how NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte responded to those attacks.
But I'm absolutely sure that the Americans will have noticed. They see what happened. They will hear this. They will take this also what it is. And that is an attack, again, on innocent civilians, on civilian infrastructure, which I think is unacceptable.
Ben, it feels a bit like Groundhog Day every time we talk about these Ukraine talks.
Yeah, and Mark Rutte saying that he's sure the Americans will have noticed that these strikes have resumed. We heard from Donald Trump's White House Press Secretary, Karoline Leavitt, saying that the president was unsurprised to learn that Russia had resumed heavy attacks on Ukraine not that long after he boasted about brokering this energy ceasefire. I don't think anyone in Ukraine was surprised at all. And I saw Zelensky sort of posting about the fact that perhaps in Russia they think there's 4 days in a week rather than seven when it comes to organising these sorts of things. I feel like we have been here so many times over the last 4 years where talks are about to begin and the Ukrainians have to pretend to be optimistic about what's going to come out of it. The Americans say, yes, a deal can be done. And then we wake up to news of 400, drones and a few dozen missiles coming into Ukrainian cities. From what I understand from the Ukrainians is they're taking the same approach that they have had since the start of the Trump administration, Mark II, that they have to be seen as being willing, cooperative, helpful, interested in peace, wanting to bring things to an end, understanding it's gone on for too long, but knowing that at the end of the day, the Russians probably simply aren't going to sign up. And I know recently we heard the Ukrainians and the Americans saying, look, it's all down to the one issue of the control of the Donetsk region. But at the same time, that has always really been the one key issue. And there's absolutely no sign at the moment that Moscow is willing to make any concessions. There will be this round of talks in the Middle East. They might agree to have another round of talks in a couple of weeks' time. The Russian attacks will continue. The four-year anniversary of the conflict will come up very soon. And there will still be huge parts of major cities in Ukraine without any power. And I've reported from Ukraine many times during the dead of winter. It gets to minus 20. It's a horrendous situation. But sadly, I don't see any way that this is going to come to an imminent end. And it does feel like perhaps the Trump administration is losing interest once again. Events in Iran are taking over, Venezuela, the whole Greenland sort of fiasco. Perhaps their interest in solving this apparently unsolvable war is waning.
Yeah, and in the lead up to those talks beginning this week, we also saw Donald Trump say he's going to slash tariffs on India after New Delhi agreed to stop buying Russian oil and start buying more from the US and potentially Venezuela. So that means India's tariff rate will drop from 50%, which was one of the highest in the world, down to 18%. Claudia, New Delhi was originally refusing to back down on this one. What's the thinking on why it's budged now?
I mean, it's still unclear if New Delhi actually has budged or if this is just Donald Trump sort of making more big claims, because when the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi came out and, you know, gave a statement after this agreement was made, he actually made no reference at all to oil and India's oil purchases or any of the details of the deal. We do know that India already had started scaling back its purchase of Russian oil from late last year. But analysts say it's highly unlikely, if not impossible, that they are going to stop buying Russian oil altogether. Because as it stands, they actually buy more oil from Russia than Venezuela is actually producing altogether. Refiners in India have said this week, you know, since this announcement, there's actually been no order from the government to stop, you know, importing oil or cancel orders for the oil that they've already purchased, even though Donald Trump did say that this tariff slash will be effective immediately. There is another element to all of this, though, in the background, and that is the deal that the EU and India struck last week. Ursula von der Leyen from the EU called this the mother of all trade deals. We're talking about the world's largest trading bloc in the EU and the world's fastest growing economy in India. And it was going to see tariffs slashed on a huge range of items going both ways. It inevitably would have led to a massive increase, and inevitably will lead to a massive increase in two-way trade between India and Europe. And that kind of would have dulled the effect of Donald Trump's tariffs on India. So I think there was also a sense that, you know, his leverage here was sort of running out, and it would have really upped the pressure on Washington to sort of get this deal done with India quickly.
Now time for a quick recap of some other big stories around the world. The Rafah border crossing, the only land crossing between Gaza and Egypt, has finally reopened after almost 2 years. Israel is closely vetting Palestinians entering or exiting the enclave and only allowing a very limited number of civilians to cross either side. Around a dozen women and children were permitted to leave and enter Gaza on Monday, despite Palestinian and Egyptian sources saying around 50 Palestinians were expected. Some 20,000 Gazans are hoping to leave for medical treatment abroad.
Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas has announced the first ever parliamentary elections. The vote is scheduled for November 1, and it's going to be the first time members of the Palestinian National Council will be chosen by popular vote rather than by appointment. Last year, Mahmoud Abbas committed to reforming the Palestinian Authority as a condition for many Western nations recognising Palestinian statehood. That included Australia. So this looks like a step towards that, although Abbas is still facing pretty consistent criticism for refusing to hold presidential elections, given he is now 21 years into what was supposed to be a four-year term.
In the United States, the FBI has raided the election headquarters in Fulton County, Georgia, seizing hundreds of boxes filled with ballots from the 2020 vote. President Trump has long insisted, without evidence and found to be untrue after multiple trials, that electoral fraud in that county cost him the state. He was recorded asking Georgia's Secretary of State to find him the 11,000 votes he needed to win. After this week's raid, he was on the phone again, this time to the agents who'd executed it, telling them they'd done a great job. He's now also doubling down on suggestions the federal government should take over elections, saying if the states can't count the votes legally and honestly, then somebody else should take it over. That is essentially calling for the Constitution to be ignored, and none of it bodes particularly well for the upcoming midterms.
And Pakistan's military have killed 177 fighters in the restive Balochistan province after 50 people were killed in a series of bomb and gun attacks claimed by the separatist Baloch Liberation Army. It was the deadliest single day for the militant group in decades, who accused the Pakistani government of monopolising the region's rich mineral resources. The assault prompted authorities to impose months-long security restrictions on Pakistan's largest province, including banning public gatherings and demonstrations.
Everyone wants to know. So here it is. Hi, Mr. President. Congratulations.
Did you watch it?
I did not. Yeah, I will see it on the news.
So that was a snippet from the trailer of Amazon's $106 million documentary, Melania. It premiered over the weekend and documents the 20 days in the lead up to Donald Trump's second inauguration from the First Lady's point of view. Claudia, I understand you've been doing a very journalistic deep dive into this one for us.
Look, you two are, you know, having all that fun in Sydney without me. I'm over here in Jakarta. I mean, I had to find something to fill my time with. And it turns out that that something was largely the First Lady's MAGA media tour, presented with the rare opportunity to interview the person who should be, I suppose, closest to the US president. Fox News did not disappoint, guys, using it to ask insightful questions like this.
I've always been curious, what is your favorite time of day? Like, are you a morning person, late night?
Favorite, it's morning.
Morning.
Very early morning.
I knew it.
Quiet, you get ready for the day, you go, you know, have a coffee.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with that.
We were just having this conversation.
When you go into an interview like that, you have to work out how interesting the responses are going to be. Yeah. And that's probably as much as she's going to give.
Yep. And you're a fellow morning person. You were just saying you love, that's your favourite part of the day, getting up, coffee, coming onto the podcast.
I'm just like Melania. Yeah. I get up, have a cup of coffee, sit around for a few hours, don't talk to my spouse. It's fascinating, this film, isn't it? Now, I've got a 24-hour flight back to London coming up tomorrow. I might actually give it a watch if it's on there. I read the review of it earlier today, the Guardian review. It's obviously, it says it's terrible, but there's a great correction at the bottom. It says the star rating for this film was corrected on the 2nd of February. A formatting issue led an earlier version to be awarded one star when the reviewer's intention was zero.
Oh, ouch. Yeah, I read one saying that her face was like a fist and her voice was the sound of metal or sheet metal. So, yeah, people are not being very kind to Melania.
You guys obviously weren't reading Fox News then, because the caption on that interview I just played for you was First Lady reveals she is a morning person. So
bit gentler.
Very newsworthy revelations being made there. Despite that gripping interview, guys, and early reports that some cinemas had only sold one ticket on the film's opening day, it actually ended up bringing in about $10 million on its opening weekend, which was the strongest start that any documentary has had in more than a decade, although, you know, when you consider the fact that Amazon spent more than 10 times that on the film and $50 million on the marketing budget alone, I think they are going to need to sell a few more tickets to turn a profit.
But I doubt Jeff Bezos really cares how much money this is. I mean, we all know why they provided this huge sum of money to make this ridiculous documentary. It's all pretty obvious, the influence and all that sort of stuff. I'm just sad that imagine if 2024 had gone the other way. We could have been watching a beautifully shot, glossy documentary called Doug.
Yeah. That would have had, same ring to it, for sure. Mm. Yeah, for sure. And the whole wardrobe, everything. Yeah.
Lost opportunity.
Lost opportunity, indeed. But now you have something to watch on the flight home, so there you go. And that is The World This Week. If you're enjoying the pod, be sure to like and subscribe. We'll have a new episode for you every Thursday.
As always, thank you very much to the wonderful producers behind World News Weekly. They are Nick Ludlam, Ali Cheevers and Billy Dallenberg. And Ben, thank you so much for hanging out with us on your holiday.
Oh, thank you for inviting me in. And I got a mug. I got a World News Weekly
welcome.
Mug. I cannot wait for British Airways to break it on the return trip.